So things are heating up without a doubt as we are traveling through the story of Jesus, and we're sort of in this section now where things are very, very quickly becoming incredibly intense. We were at the Last Supper, seeming to be in a place where all of the promises and prophecies that have been spoken over the centuries were sort of emerging. We were excited about the reality that Jesus might actually be the Messiah who will rescue his people, the Jewish people, from their oppressor, Rome, and set them up once and for all forever. So the Last Supper was sort of the biggest, most extraordinary moment of wonder and height. And since then, it's intensely gone what we might perceive as wrong if we are hoping Jesus is going to rescue the Jewish people from Rome. Jesus had left the Last Supper with his disciples, crossed the Kidron Valley into the Garden of Gethsemane. There, a bunch of soldiers showed up with a bunch of high priests and, with a bunch of priests and a bunch of people that were intensely against what Jesus was doing. They were all part of the religious institution of the day, and they were tasked with guarding that institution, and Jesus was an affront to that institution. And so they got him arrested. There was an incident with Peter who pulled his sword and chopped a guy's ear off, and those are some intense moments. You're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then it got settled down, and the soldiers fell back, and they were like, oh, and Jesus, well, you can take me, and you know, all that stuff happened. And now Jesus has been taken down into the system, the court system. And the way it flows, as you remember, is he goes to the high priest first, because he needs to go before the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish court system that rules over. And you really start with the person in most power there, which at this point in time, although Caiaphas was high priest, his father-in-law Annas was the godfather of the big family that was the high priest family. There were five families like that, and he was one of them. So he goes to Annas. Annas questions him, sends him to Caiaphas. Peter is following along. John is following along. Peter denies Jesus in the midst of the story. And then as he goes to Caiaphas and he is questioned by the Sanhedrin, this is very early in the morning now. And now the governor's house opens up and they can go to the regional governor, the prefect of Rome, to go and talk with him about the situation. So we've gone Annas and then the high priest. So we've got a conviction now from the Jewish ruling body, and now we're going to Rome. Rome functioned this way in many ways. Whenever they would conquer a region, their philosophy was allow the people of that region as much as possible to kind of govern themselves. And what our job is as the Roman Empire is to take the key ideas that are our ideas and make sure that we push just those key ideas down the system. And then we make sure that the people in the region from multiple different cultures and ideas and religions and stuff, that they all get along and that nothing gets out of hand. That's the job of the prefect, to kind of diplomatically navigate all the ins and outs of people's ideas and thoughts and differences, and to make sure, while doing that, that the people have a healthy respect for Caesar, and ultimately translates into pay taxes. Pay your taxes, okay? So that's the prefect's job. When something cannot be handled by the local group of people, they would bring it to the prefect to say, this is out of our hands, it's above our jurisdiction, you need to step into that. So that's kind of what's happening here. They've convicted Jesus of blasphemy, that is saying things that would put him higher than God or make him God, and that was punishable in the Jewish system by stoning or death. But things had changed with Rome in play, and so they needed to move to Caesar's house, to the prefect's house. In this current time, the prefect's name was Pontius Pilate, and let's go there and see what unfolds in the story as we step in. Grab your Bibles, and we're going to turn to the book of John. If you don't have a Bible with you, there are Bibles under the seats. Grab one of those and turn with me there. John chapter 18, page 774 of our Bible, 774, John chapter 18. We see the John chapter 18, we've been with Annas and Caiaphas. The high priest questions Jesus. Peter denies him again. And then in verse 28, it says this: then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. So just recognize, literally, the governor's house has just opened up. You don't really want to, you know how you go to work Monday morning, first thing, and you're kind of hoping it's going to be a relatively easy day? Well, Pilate, Pontius Pilate, who's the governor at this time, his first experience early in the morning is a mob showing up in his house with Jesus, and he already knows what's going on with this story. He already has information on this story, so you know he's just going, oh, you've got to be kidding me. All right, let's get this dealt with, and let's do it quickly. It's early. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled and could eat the Passover. Okay, so we are, remember, in the seven-day festival or feast of unleavened bread. The beginning of that feast is the Passover meal, and then it runs for 7 days. They've just had the Passover meal that night. This is not saying that these others hadn't eaten Passover. They all ate Passover the night before, but the Passover meal is captured in a seven-day experience in this festival of unleavened bread. And if a Jewish person, especially a priest, enters into a Gentile's home, a non-Jewish person's home, they would automatically have to go through a cleansing process because they would be unclean because they went into an unclean place. Now, the rule was funny. You could go into a Gentile's basic vicinity of their house, their yard, for instance, as long as it wasn't covered by a roof. I don't totally get you, maybe the air or the sun, but you weren't unclean if you kind of stepped in the courtyard. You were only unclean if you went in the house. So the governor's house or mansion is sort of a quasi-courthouse where you could come in and then you would go inside into the courtroom, if you will, and there you would have the dialogue. But these guys, they don't want to go inside. And it just demonstrates here, as Pilate comes outside to meet them, even though Jesus is inside, we begin to get a taste of who this man Pilate is, why he is so good at what he does, why he holds this position. He was appointed in 26 AD by Tiberius to be prefect of the Jewish region. He held that position till AD 36 for 10 years. It was a political process for him, and he is reigning as the director of a very hot spot. It would be like becoming the ambassador of the U.S. to regions of the Middle East or some of the other areas in the world that are particularly hot spots. And so you know this guy's good at what he does. And what he's good at is getting a feel for what's actually going on, what's underlying, and trying to do as much as possible to maintain order and therefore peace, right? So he understands how the Jewish people work. He doesn't have to buy it. He doesn't have to believe it. He just has to understand it. That is how this world functioned, how Rome did what Rome did, is they recognized that they were a global society, because in that time Rome was global. It was all over the entire known world. And so you have multiple cultural ideas, religious ideas, just philosophical ideas. They're all in the mix. And so in order to maintain order within that kind of world, you just sort of step back and you create a general format in which everybody can function and everybody can have their ideas and have a blast. And that's what Pilate was brilliant at. So the Jewish people deliver Jesus. He goes into the courthouse. They're standing outside the courthouse. They're hanging out. We find out that Pilate knew some things that John doesn't tell us he knew. Remember, the Gospels tell a story like a 3D movie, each having its layer, and you need to read all simultaneously to get the full story. In the book of Matthew and in Luke's account, there are some things that come out of there that we need to know about before we continue reading here in John. Number one, Pontius Pilate already perceived or knew, based on the political system that was going on during that time, that there was envy going on, that Jesus had a big following, and that the Jewish religious leaders didn't like him. He already knew that they were coming into his house because they were envious of Jesus and they wanted him to be cast out or banished or put down, and we'll find out in a second how far they wanted that to go. So Pontius Pilate is like that parent when two kids are coming and they're fighting and you already know what it's about, but you got to let them talk it out so that you can help them see. That's Pilate. He also has something else going for him, right? He has a wife who clearly is very perceptive to the realities of his ongoing career. Very rarely do you meet anyone in politics that is ascending the political ladder that doesn't have a spouse behind them that is navigating that with them if they're married. And so oftentimes in politics, the spouse behind the scenes is the brilliant mind behind the scenes also, right? And so here, this is obviously no exception. They're in Jerusalem. She really wants to be in Paris as their next 10-year gig. And so it's like, like you gotta work this right and have the right stuff. But in this particular case, something unique happens. We find out in Matthew that she has some dreams that day about Jesus. And those dreams declare to her that he is a righteous man and that Pontius Pilate's going to get himself in a lot of trouble if he deals with this one. So she actually bothers to send word to her husband and says this, "Don't touch this one with a 10-foot pole, man. This righteous man, there's stuff going on here much bigger than you can see. Be very cautious. Let it go. Put it back in the other sandbox. This is not something you want to touch." And she literally says, "I have been haunted by horrible dreams about this. Take my word for it." When your spouse sends you a note like that, it definitely perks up the attention, doesn't it? And you're like, okay, I've got to walk into this one very delicately. This one has mess written all over it, and I know how to handle mess. That's what Pontius Pilate does. He handles mess. So watch. Watch what he does. So it says, "So Pilate went outside to them and said, 'What accusation do you bring against this man?'" See, Pilate knows that they're envious of this man. He knows that Jesus hasn't done anything yet that could cause him to be convicted by the Roman law. He has stayed well within the Roman law. And so Pilate is wanting to kind of teach them something. Tell me the accusation so that as soon as they bring an accusation forward, Pilate can say, "Guys, this is none of my business. This is your business. You deal with him." So he says, "What accusation?" I love this answer. They answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." This is an answer I get in my house all the time. I ask a direct question and I get a different answer that has nothing to do with a direct question that is somehow telling me how my question is irrelevant because there's a bigger picture here. Who ate the donut? "Well, I went on a bike ride and I was tired and I came in and Cullen was eating a donut." Okay, did Cullen eat this donut? "No, I didn't say that. I wouldn't have said that. But you see, it was hot, and then Hope, I saw Hope yesterday eating a donut." Okay, back to the question. Who ate the donut? You see, we do this. We have these questions that we want to say something so that we can put a stop to the questioning, and that's what they're doing here. "Pilate, it's early in the morning. Do you really think we would have brought Jesus to you, bothered you with this, if we didn't already know he was doing terrible things? Do you really have to ask us what they are? Because we're still thinking." That's sort of what they're doing here, right? Pilate knows what they're going to bring to the table is this. He's a blasphemer. He thinks he's God. And then Pilate's able to say, "We don't deal with those issues. Those are like in the religious realm, and Rome doesn't toy with that. Just deal with it yourselves, okay?" They answered him this, and Pilate said to them, "Take him yourself and judge him by your own law." So Pilate's not even going to bother. He's like, "You know what? You guys have a court. We allow you to have it. You go do your thing. I don't care." And here it is. Here's the key. The Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Bam, there it is. What's going on here? See, number one, they're asking for something, aren't they? What are they asking for? The death penalty. They are suggesting in their conversation with Pilate that Jesus needs to be put to death quickly. He's big trouble, and they don't have the authority to put them to death. 40 years before the destruction of the temple, which is in 70 AD, we find out through historical documents that the right of the Jewish court to effect the death penalty was removed by Rome. There was too much chaos going on. The religious institution had become overly zealous with all of this stuff. And so if you step to the left or the right and you didn't do exactly what you were supposed to by the religious system, you just get stoned. And so it had gotten out of hand. Too many people were dying at the hands of this court that constantly thought stoning people was a good idea. And so Rome came in and said, "Look, you can do whatever you want to these people. You can beat them, you can do what, but you can't put them to death. That's our call. We are the only ones that can affect the death penalty." If you go back from 70 AD, 40 years, you are right around the time in within the few years of this trial going on, because this trial is going on around 33, 34 AD. And so just a few years before this moment in this courtyard, the ability for the Jewish people to court to effect death was removed by Rome. So they make this statement. "Well, we would, but his crimes, they require death and we can't do that. So that's why we're here." Now Pilate knows why they're there. They want the death penalty. We find out in the other gospels, what they brought to the table to Pilate was not that he was a blasphemer. What they in fact said was this. They said this. Listen, Jesus is running around claiming to be the king of the Jews. And if we may, he's claiming to be the Messiah, the one who's going to overthrow all governments that are over the Jewish people, and he will reign above Caesar. There it is. Those words are treason to the Roman government. If you think you are greater than Caesar and you can overthrow Caesar, you are trouble. Big trouble. And the group of people that played this game a lot were the group called the Zealots. They were the Jewish people, the Jewish terrorists, if you will. They were the guys that felt it was by all these subservient, horrible things, blowing stuff up and doing things that you moved government out. We will overthrow Rome with violence. That was the Zealots' way. And so they were very passionate. And Jesus here is being brought to Pilate, presented as a zealot. He's kind of going, this guy, he's trouble. He thinks he's going to overthrow Rome and he doesn't like Caesar. And in fact, we've heard him say that we should no longer in any way give any thought to Caesar. In fact, we shouldn't even pay taxes. I'm sure one of them threw it out there. He said no taxes, which isn't true, of course, at all. We know what Jesus said. And Pilate knows this too. Pilate, I mean, I could literally see Pilate going, oh man, this is going to be a long day. So he walks back inside. And it says, verse 33, so Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, look, are you the king of the Jews? So just follow this conversation now. What is Pilate trying to do here? He's a diplomat. He's trying to work this system so he can make everybody as happy as possible. He doesn't want to see this guy die. That's a ridiculous idea. But remember, Pilate doesn't function in the idea of trying to discover what is right or what is true and then running with that. His job is not to discover what is right or what is true. His job is to discover what is most politically best to result in what? Order. His job is order. So whatever I can affect to create the best order, sometimes it's picking between two evils, right? Which one's going to be the worst case scenario? And then you pick the other one, even though neither are really right. That's the complex world we live in. And here, Pilate is asking him a question. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? What an interesting question Jesus asks. So Pilate asks him, and here's all Pilate wants, right? He's trying to determine whether Jesus is a zealot at this point. He wants to see that burning anger in Jesus' eyes. Are you the king of the Jews? And then that soapbox that pops up that tends to be in us zealots, right? And then you're suddenly like, yes or no, who told you that? I've never said that, but I'm going to do, you know, He's probing now. And Jesus' answer is, did you figure this out or did someone tell you this? Now, Pilate's not exactly thrilled by that answer. And he says, am I a Jew? Jesus, do I look like a Jew to you? Because look, here's the deal. You are standing in front of me right now because those guys out there, your people, the Jewish people, the leadership there, they're the ones bringing you to me. This isn't my doing, this isn't my deal, this isn't my gig, but I am the governor and this is what I've got to do. And yes, I don't know whether you're the king of the Jews or not the king of the Jews, I really couldn't care less. But the truth is, what you've got to start caring about are those guys out there because they are going to deliver you over to me and I have the power, P.S., to set you free and to tell them to leave you alone or to have you killed. So watch your mouth and think through the answers carefully. Do you see what Pilate's doing? Now, I got all of that speech from three different gospels and all the different pieces that come together where Pilate is trying to express to Jesus, you are not in a good spot right now. The problem isn't me. The problem is them, and I can help you with this. I don't want to see you die. I just want to get through this. I've got a long day. And Jesus, among other things, does tell Pilate at one point, I know you think you have power over my life and my death. But you don't. I'm so sorry to tell you. You are just part of a story that is going to unfold. Thanks for playing your part. What can I do for you now? That is, in essence, what's going to happen. But that is not all that Jesus tells Pilate. Jesus makes something happen here that if we don't pay close attention, we miss perhaps one of the greatest statements that Jesus declares outside of the Jewish context. Because Jesus is not in a Jewish context now. So all this time that I've been telling you, watch for the words of Jesus, see how they tie back to the Old Testament, see what they draw out, ignore all of that for this one conversation. Why? Because Jesus is in a courtroom, none none of the Jewish people are with him. Why? Because the Bible told us that. All of the Jewish people are outside because they can't come in the house. So we have been given a context by God. That's why John put that in there, so that we know the context we're in. We are having a secular conversation with a secular leader in secular language. So don't look for all sorts of Old Testament tiebacks. They're not going to be there. Jesus is going to simply say what needs to be said to that community. We are now not dealing with a religious institution or with Jesus' disciples. We are dealing with culture at large. And so here's what Jesus answers. Pilate says, Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done? He's looking to give Jesus a way out. Jesus answered, Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not of this world. Did you hear that? This is Jesus standing before the prefect of Rome in the entire Jewish region. And he just said to this guy, I'm not from here. I'm from somewhere else. And where I come from, yes, it is a kingdom. And yes, it has an army. And yes, if I wanted them to, they could destroy all of this. And yes, the only way I get delivered into the hands of anybody is by my choice, asking my kingdom to stand down while I effect something much bigger. I am not from here. I mean, this is that moment in humanity where we suddenly see our world expand to a whole nother level. We suddenly recognize we're not alone. There's something bigger. And we miss it because we're caught up in trying to create order in our little teeny sandbox. Watch. It says here this. Then Pilate said to him, so, just let me get this straight then so we can get this cleared up. You are a king then, yes? Do you see what Pilate's doing? Okay, can we go back to the original question? I know you're from another planet and all that kind of stuff, but are you a king? Because my job is simple here today, Jesus. I'm just trying to figure out if you're a zealot endangering Rome, because if you're not, I can put a stop to this whole thing and set you free. If you are, then it's going to get a little more complicated for you. So I get the planet thing. Are you a king? And what are you going to do? Is that army you just talked about coming here? Are they going to attack Rome? Do you see what Pilate's trying to do? Guys, if you read this in its context, it all begins to make sense. Look, Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. Well, you are right. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world. Now he's about to give Pilate the reason behind his idea that he's come from another place and he's here on this planet. Look, I to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of truth listens to my voice. There it is. That was the answer Pilate needed. He just needed that answer. Pilate isn't interested in this moment at discovering the wondrous possibility that this man standing before him is from another place who knows things beyond Pilate's wildest imagination and who holds and embodies in of himself all of the answers that mankind longs to discover. That didn't dawn on Pilate. What Pilate was involved in his small little world was, I got to get through today. There's a bunch of crazies out there that want to kill you. I need you to say something that allows me to go, oh, he's not a danger to Rome. Got it. And Jesus just said it in the middle of one of the most dramatic statements that a human being could dare to make if it turns out he's not a human being. Pilate sees it this way. I'm here to declare truth to the world. I'm from another planet. I'm not here to kill anyone. Good. That's all I needed to know. You're not a zealot. And this is how he answers it, right? He realizes he's now in the philosophical. We've moved from science and from stuff we can touch and feel and observe. We've moved into the religious, the eternal, the other planet stuff, and none of us really know what that is. So Pilate, rightly, says this. Pilate said to him, well, Jesus, what is truth anyways, right? Do you see what Pilate's doing here? Got it, man. You're here to do truth. Love that story. Keep it up. After all, what is truth anyway? Sometimes we read this like Pilate was like, tell me, what is truth? I'm like, no. Think of what Pilate's job is. So he's like, You're here to declare truth from another place. You know everything. Great. I'm going to go let them know we're cool. And look, he goes outside and he says this. Look, he does exactly that. After he said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. I find no guilt in him. Now, the little piece of the puzzle here that we don't find out in this gospel, that we find out in the gospel of Matthew is, after he does this, the Jewish people, this little mob, are not satisfied at all, and they start crying for crucifixion. So imagine this, it's like one of those deals like, okay, I've talked with him, he's not a zealot, he's not a danger to Rome, we're good, he's a philosopher, he's got some crazy ideas, I get that part, but they're not gonna hurt you, they're not gonna hurt us. Crucify him! He's a traitor to Rome! You're missing the point! So here's what he does, right? It doesn't tell us here, it tells us in Matthew. He says, fine, you know what? Enough of this. I'm going to wash my hands of this guy because I see no fault in him. Take him to Herod. Herod. Ooh, Herod. Herod was a plague to the Jewish people, right? Because Herod was the king of the Jews at that time. He was appointed by the Roman government through a political navigation of the system. And Herod was a joke, folks. He was truly an idiot in every sense of the word when you look at him. He was a joke. And his entire system was a joke, and the Jewish people knew that. That's why they didn't go to Herod in the first place. They went through the Sanhedrin because they're like, that guy doesn't even know how to handle these kinds of situations. And this is confirmed to us in the book of Matthew. Pilate says, you know what? You've done the Sanhedrin thing. You've brought him to me. I find no fault. Take him to Herod and have Herod decide what to do with this. This is a Jewish issue. This is not a Roman issue. So as a matter of fulfilling what Pilate asks, they take him to Herod. Here's what happens with Herod, right? You can read about this in Matthew chapter 27. He goes to Herod, and you know what Herod's excited about? He's like, oh my gosh, I get to meet Jesus. Maybe he'll do a miracle for me. That's Herod's deal. I'm not even kidding. Go read it. He's like, Herod was excited to see Jesus because he thought he would do some kind of cool thing. So Jesus shows up at Herod, and the Bible says Herod was questioning him and like asking him, come on, do something fun. Look, everybody, it's the magician. And Jesus just stood there and did nothing. He didn't say anything. And so you know what Herod does? Herod does what people like Herod do. He goes, get some robes. He's king of the Jew. Dress him up in purple. And they dress Jesus up. I'm not, go look in Matthew. He dresses up in a bunch of like formal royal robes and he goes, send him back to Pilate, he's boring. Now it doesn't say that, but that's exactly what I anticipate happened. Herod said, you know, you're no fun, go away. Herod was just a partier. And really his political position was irrelevant, it just existed. And so that's what happens when you're in an irrelevant position, you just use it for power. So he goes back to Pilate and Pilate gets Jesus back. And then Pilate begins to dig through this thing and realizes in the process of all of this that the right and the wrong is so gray in this. And so up there in the philosophical realm, the easiest way to put a stop to this is just to give these Jewish people what they want. See, the religious institution was established by God to preserve the character and nature of God and the beauty of the promise of God, to preserve the gospel, right? And instead, they began to fall into self-preservation and they became this horrid force of legalistic arrogance and self-righteousness that alienated everyone from the truth. And eventually, when the truth showed up in body form, actually became the greatest enemy of the truth. The culture, on the other hand, has the opposite response. It's hands-off on the truth, right? Global culture is always hands-off on truth. Here's why. Because Pilate's question was totally valid, wasn't it? I mean, after all, what is truth, folks? Do you know? Yeah, now I get it. There's certain things in our ability to observe that we've discovered to be true. The earth is indeed not flat. Who knew? It's actually round. And we discovered that. And now we can officially say, using this idea of truth, the world is round, right? It's not flat. Why did we think it was flat in the first place? Because if you stood here and you look that way, what does it look like? Flat. Doesn't look round. As far as your eye can see, it goes that way. So if someone says to you, it's actually curved and goes around the other side, you go, you're crazy. Until we can get a larger view of the entire thing, right? That's how us human beings work. Our ability to discern what is true and what is not is limited to the amount of observation, information, and experience we have. So for the small little sandbox we play on in our planet and our little solar system and our little universe, where we get to see some things and test some things and do the scientific method, which I love and I think is awesome, we get to poke and prod at people and then figure stuff out. In that world, we can discern truth. We can. But as soon as truth moves beyond that world of clear observation and experience and information, and we move into a world where none of us have been and none of us have returned from, now it's just a plethora of ideas, because that's all we've got. And it is our job as human beings to weed through the haystack of ideas in the hopes that we will discover the needle in the haystack that actually is what we might call the truth. And then that needle will lead us into the needle maker and figure out what all that is. And so we all throw our ideas on the table. This is a consequence of the fall of man. In the Garden of Eden, we were created to image the reality of God, to literally just be a reflection and display of who God is. In other words, He is truth, and He reveals truth to us, and our discovery of truth is by Him, because He embodies truth. He is truth, and so He makes propositions to us, He gives us ideas, and then we go and we live out those ideas. We actually tangibly live them out. And that's what we were created to do. It was an incredibly freeing reality that us human beings were created into. We get to discover truth from the needle maker Himself, and then we get to affect that by the way we live. And then the enemy came to us and said this: He has something you don't. Big ideas. He knows stuff you don't know. And if you know everything He knows, then you can be just like Him, and you won't need Him anymore. Remember, if you eat of the fruit of good and evil, then you will what? Know what He knows. The enemy convinced us that truth wasn't embodied in a person. Truth was, in fact, an idea that He happened to have, that if we had, we could be the same as Him. So we bought into it. And what we discovered on the other side was that truth is very complex and extremely broad, and has millions of facets to it. And the only way you can know which is truth and which is lies and which is right and which is wrong and which is safe and which is dangerous is by having a view of the full scope of things, except for one small problem. We got the knowledge that truth is out there somewhere, but we did not get the ability to be divine. We got death instead. So our pursuit of truth is this futile attempt to weed through a haystack of ideas and thoughts that over generations have been generated by us human beings about what's actually out there. And we get to pick and choose, and my haystack piece is blue, yours is green. And so here's what we do. In our pursuit of truth, we realize the futility of our ability to discover what truth is. And so we begin to fight with one another about whose truth is a better one. My truth is more logical than your truth, and my truth has better implications than your truth, and so we start fighting. And then we end up in chaos. And what do we want to end up in? Chaos or order? No, we want to end up in order. So what is the only natural, logical conclusion in order to create order in a global society when you've got multiple ideas about stuff none of us know about anyways, and we're fighting over them? You create relative truth. You say this: I'll tell you what. Since none of us can really know about any of that, since none of us can know what truth is, how about we do this? Let truth be whatever you want it to be. Until we can observe and discover what it actually is, and then we can argue over that. But since none of us can discover what's out there, what's eternal life, what's after death, who created everything, is there someone in control, is there a God, are we on our own, is this the consequence of a natural evolutionary craziness, what is it, which answer is it? Since we can't possibly know, just pick one, run with it, and let's all get along. That's how we work. That's our only option. So Pilate is right. If the question is, well, what is truth anyways? Then our answer is this: Jesus, since you're from another planet, clearly, and I'm clearly not, let's just agree to disagree. You go about your way, teach whatever truth you want to teach. I'll teach my truth. Let's get along. That's what we do. That was Pilate's answer. Guys, I find no fault in him. He's cool. He's a philosopher. You know those guys. Jesus, on the other hand, presents us with a whole different idea, doesn't he? Jesus didn't come to us and say, at the table of the Last Supper. I have words and ideas that I want to give to you, and they are truth, and you will discover them. What did he say? I am the truth. See what he said? I am the truth. In John chapter 17, verse 3, he says, "For this is eternal life, that you might know the Father and know me, that you would know truth. Because if you know truth, then you have life." So what Jesus is saying is this, just like Peter discovered when Jesus said, "Are you going to leave? There's 1,000 ideas out there. Mine just sounded really weird. Are you going to go?" This is what Peter's conclusion was when Jesus was sharing ideas, propositions, truths that were true but were hard truths. And everybody left saying, "This guy's insane. I want a different truth." Peter said, "Where do you want me to go, Jesus? Because all truth seems to be held inside your words. You hold the words of eternal life. Where do you want me to go?" Peter got it. Truth is embodied in this person because this person not only claims to be from somewhere else, all of time has proven it to be true. When Jesus showed up on the planet, let's see. Granted, you could argue, well, how do we know it's really a virgin? But he was born of a virgin. That's odd. Then there were a bunch of angels involved and people traveling from the east following a star. That's odd. Then there was all of the incidences that took place with people trying to kill babies because he was one of them. That's odd. Then there was the 12-year-old incident in the temple where the great high priests of that time in Jerusalem couldn't stump a 12-year-old and couldn't figure out how on earth he knew this much when he hadn't learned all this stuff. It was as though he knew everything beforehand. That was odd. And then there was, of course, the baptism with the dove and the voice from heaven. That was odd. And then there was the temptation. And then there was the whole storm incident. Stop! Everything stops. That was definitely odd. Then there was raising the dead. There was healing the sick. There was making the blind see. And there was teaching with such authority that everyone from every culture in every background came and listened into this man. That was odd. Then there was the crucifixion. That wasn't so odd. But the resurrection, now that was odd. And then, of course, there was the ascension. And that was odd. You see, at a certain point, like the disciples did, you start going, "He's not from around here." And so all those disciples, when faced with the option of denying their faith in Jesus, the one that they had discovered to be not from around here, they opted for death. You know that all the disciples except for John died a martyr's death, some of them terrible deaths, when they were asked to abandon their faith in Jesus, not their faith in an idea or a truth, in Jesus. And they said, "Are you kidding me? He floated into the sky and he said, 'Don't worry, you're with me. Go ahead, do your worst, because I already figured out that the only one I need to trust is Jesus.' And then whatever propositions or truths or ideas he throws out, I will utilize those as a baseline by which to discern all the other ideas that I get to explore." You see, here's the trouble. Here's the trouble. If we are the religious institution who holds onto a religious idea, then what our reaction to that is this: our idea is right, all of your ideas are wrong, and the haystack is evil. Burn it. Have you ever experienced Christianity that way? "Don't read those books. Don't listen to those people. Don't talk to those people. Banish them all." Yeah, of course. And then we do that. You're wearing what? You're reading what? "You did not read that book. I don't even know if I can enter your home now. I might be unclean." Let's just be honest. That's how we roll, right? Because granted, our motives are somewhat correct. We're wanting to preserve the idea that God gave us from the horror of the world, and we protect everyone from it. But guess what that results in its end point? Is a religious institution protecting itself rather than protecting the promise, the gospel. Of course, in our culture, we have the other idea. Those are all the narrow-minded, arrogant, judgmental Christians. And we here at Mosaic, we don't want to have any part of that, right? So we float over to here. "Look, we have a good idea. It's Christianity, and we know Jesus is true, but we have to be incredibly delicate with that idea because it's an idea among many ideas, and we're in a culture that values many ideas." So tolerance, this word tolerance, which we throw around to mean something it was never meant to mean anyways, we go, we just have to be very delicate and kind of throw them out on the table and just kind of go, "Here's one for you, just to add into the mix you might want to think about. Not trying to offend. You see, we end up being Pilate on the other hand, where we just say, in order not to offend anyone, I'm just going to keep my ideas very, very surface level. And so we do this in our churches too. We become churches that deal with these ideas, these very surface ideas, so that we can all get along. And we don't want to delve into too many of the deeper ideas that start affecting your actual life, because then you got to do stuff you don't want to do. And then that's where we come in. This is the other part of us that we do all the time. You see, in our natural day-to-day behavior, here's how it affects our mission. Both these horrid ideas affect our mission every day. If we fall into this camp, this is how you and I tend to do it, right? We discover Jesus as truth, and then we discover his ways, and they're awesome. And then we discover obedience, and we start living in it. And then our life starts shaping toward obedience, and we discover those freedoms. And then before you know it, we've lived in obedience long enough that the darkness of that other world is more evident than before, right? And then we start doing this one. We go to people and we say, you really ought to live this way. Look, you really ought to think about doing it the way I'm doing it. We start projecting our obedience to Christ onto a bunch of other people. And we come up with brand new ideas that aren't even in the Bible. You can't do that. Why not? Because it's got to be wrong. I know it is. It feels wrong. I don't do it. And so we start doing that. It's subtle, but it's there. Or this one I love. This is my favorite because we all do this one. I do this one. I say that I believe in Jesus. I say that Jesus embodies truth. I say that Jesus is truth itself, and when he speaks, his words are truth, except for those few I read that affect this little thing I want to do right now. See what I'm doing? Yep. I mean, I know his ways are true, but he doesn't understand the context of our delicate global society, or he doesn't understand the context of this delicate relationship I'm developing with this other person, or he doesn't understand the intricacies of a business and how sometimes you got to just be a little bit more this than a little bit more that. And I get what he says, and it's cool, but I just don't know that it fully applies in this situation. We justify ourselves in our behavior so that we can keep behaving how we want to, and what we end up doing is we are a pilot. We're saying to the world, this is a great idea, but I don't really totally believe it because it doesn't apply here, so it's okay. And then all we end up being is part of the plethora of great ideas out there. And we are not a force to drive people toward the needle maker. We are a force that keeps them from him because we say the whole haystack's cool. You with me? So either you drive people away from Jesus by being arrogant and narrow-minded and holding on to ideas that really don't matter in terms of how it affects people, or you're so general that the whole haystack is cool. Both ways, we totally miss the point that there's a needle in there somewhere that leads us to the needle maker. And what we discovered is we don't need to go after the needle anymore. Why not? Because the needle maker showed up and said, I'm right here. That's Jesus saying, you don't need to try to find the needle in a haystack anymore. I'm the needle maker. And if you hang out with me and you learn my rhythms and you learn my ways and you learn my truths, you will discover the needle in good time because I have the needle. And so what we get to do on mission is to live our lives in righteousness, to authenticate what we say is true, what we have discovered to be true, that Jesus' ways are truth because he is truth, and simultaneously, never to project our judgment on the rest of the planet. Because we are simply a messenger of displaying the freedom that comes with redemption. And they will discover it through our words and our actions as we declare and demonstrate Jesus is indeed the one who is not from here. And it's been proven our faith is not blind, but our faith is squarely placed not in a truth, but in the person who is truth. In my home, this is exactly what I hope happens, that my kids recognize that I have experience and knowledge and observation that they do not. So when I tell them, I'm not going to leave you and abandon you to try to discern in our home what is right and wrong, what is safe and dangerous, what is good and bad, what is truth and what is not, because you don't have the ability, the experience, the observation, or the knowledge to know. I'm going to tell you this. Trust what? Me, that I know. And then when I give you truth, you can take that and use that as a point to discern the thousands of ideas that thousands of others will throw at you while you travel through your life. But start with this one. Not a truth, a person. You with me? And Jesus says that to us. Don't start with an idea. There are too many of them and you don't have the power to see what you need to see to understand them. Start with me. Trust me because I have seen and I do know. I am from a kingdom that is not from around here. And I am the king of that kingdom. And I have been sent to you to do what? Slaughter you. No. To declare to you the truth and to rescue you from the abandoning of that truth in the garden where you chose to pursue the haystack instead of pursuing me, the needle maker. We're insane. We went after the haystack instead of the needle maker to find a needle that would lead us to the needle maker because we thought maybe we would be the needle maker. It's insane. We've been redeemed from that. Trust Jesus and follow him, and you will find truth. Let's pray. God, I think it's an extraordinary thing that you stood before Pilate, the secular culture of the day, and said to him, I'm not from here. I'm from another place, and I bring to you truth. I think it's just as extraordinary that he missed it, just like we often do, because he was too busy trying to figure out how to navigate the haystack of ideas that we have come up with over the generations to try to figure out how on earth to navigate life and death and eternity. Remind us this day, God, that our freedom as Christ followers is not that we have discovered an idea that is the truth, but that we have discovered the person who embodies all of it. So you have not shown us all things, and we do not understand all truth, but you have shown us yourself, and we understand you enough to know that if you say it, we believe it. If you say it, we can count on it. If you say it, we can follow it. And in time, it will give us what we need to interact safely and beautifully with all of the ideas that are in the haystack, because we will be able to discern which ones are truth, which ones are lies, which ones are dangerous, which ones are safe. And we will be able to be expressions to this world, not of a single idea, but of a single person who embodies all the good ideas. Allow us to focus on you, Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, the truth, eternal life, all of that embodied in you. And may we drive toward trusting you enough to do and say what you ask us to do and say, and to follow you with all of our hearts. We want to stand for you, believe in you, trust in you. Thank you for showing that to us in this story as you confronted the culture of your day with these incredible statements. We love you, Jesus. Amen.